Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Welcome to another week of Behind the Curtain, where I, Jack Berkman, as a Washington lobbyist, give you a behind-the-scenes perspective on all that's going on in Washington. I'm not a talking head. I'm not a journalist. I walk the halls of Congress and work my contacts every week of the year, every day of the year. I go to dinners and parties and get you information the press couldn't dream of getting. What a show we have this week. My God, it's a shame we only have an hour. We're going to get into the Mueller investigation. We'll get into the Iran deal. Talk about the state of journalism in America. Don't miss that one. And finally, with our friend Greg Corumbus, we'll talk all about the primary results earlier in this week. What a political week. A number of more important weeks coming this spring. What does it all mean for the Donald? What does it all mean for November? We'll be breaking it down with Brother Corumbus. But first up, we have Megan Barth, ReaganBabe.com. Megan, welcome.
Well, thanks so much, Jack. Good to be with you. Well, thanks for having me back.
I am getting so tired of talking about Mueller's investigation or non-investigation. I really can barely stand it. I mean, let me try to recap it in 2 minutes. The whole thing has become a fishing expedition, which is broader and more ridiculous than any special counsel has ever done. It has yielded literally nothing. You've got the 12 Russians that he claims interfered with the DNC servers. Of course, we can't talk to them, bring them back, communicate with them in any way, because they're all in Moscow and St. Petersburg. We don't even know if they're real people. We don't even know if they're still living or they exist. It's just something Mueller claims happened. Then we've got here, we've got Mr. Flynn and Mr. Gates have pled guilty, but only obstruction. And that's because they had no money. And Mueller was spending millions of dollars and asked them the same question 10 times and forced them into plea deals on obstruction, which is nuts. Now they're going after Cohen, which has absolutely nothing to do with Mueller's mandate, which is the Russia investigation, in the blind hope that somehow Cohen knows something about Trump. He's plunging into the Stormy Daniels sex thing on the ground somehow that Trump's payment to Stormy Daniels, if in fact Trump did know about the payment, some confusion about that, was designed to influence an election. You couldn't have a broader fishing expedition than what Mueller is doing, could you?
No, I don't think so. Unless Stormy Daniels is a Russian prostitute, I really don't know what she has to do with the investigation.
Ah, that would be an interesting twist.
It could be a twist, right? But Judge T.S. Ellis III, just last week, completely rebuked Mueller's team. He questioned whether Mueller was overstepping his prosecutorial power, and which we all think that he is. Because, again, what does Stormy Daniels, what does Michael Cohen have to do with this Russian collusion narrative? But also, he says, it's unlikely you're going to persuade me the special counsel has unfettered power to do whatever he wants. And this is really what it boils down to, is this unfettered power, which some Democrats, or all Democrats, and some Republicans are trying to protect through legislation.
You know, I'll make some news here. We have a special announcement. My friend Larry Klayman and I, this Friday, are holding a press conference here in Roslyn, where we're announcing a large reward for whistleblowers within the Mueller investigation. What do you think of that, Megan? We're going to go right to the source, making news here today. I think we'll get some people come forth.
Well, I know Larry, and I think he's a great prosecutor, and great for you guys. I really hope it does produce some fruit and some results and some whistleblowers. But looking at the Mueller team, you've got many Hillary Clinton supporters and donors, even some that were at the Hillary Victory Party, which really turned into a funeral. And so, good luck with that. I think it's great. I think it's going to be great for some publicity, but perhaps people will come forward and see that the law is completely being turned upside down, whereby we're not investigating a crime. We're investigating a person in order to try to find a crime. And anyone
that's
of
well
us
said. That's very, very well said. We're not investigating a crime. We're investigating a person to try to find a crime. That's actually a very, very dynamic encapsulation of the whole Mueller thing. Good job.
Well, thank you. And then I also have to bring up the political or legal theory of the fruit of the poisonous tree.
Yeah.
And that is where you cannot, a case will be completely thrown out if evidence was manufactured, if it was planted, if it was gained by warrantless means. Well, when you look at all of the quote unquote evidence that Mueller has, it was generated by a political opposition research firm on behalf of a political candidate concocted by foreign agents.
Of course, and getting back to the dossier and our friend Christopher Steele, which is the entire intellectual impetus which launched the whole Russia investigation was fraudulent and paid for by a Democratic law firm, the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Perkins Coie law firm.
Right. Disguised as payments to GPS for specifically this dossier. I don't understand why Mueller really isn't looking into the Russian collusion that the Hillary campaign engaged in.
Well, going back to your point, though, what you said, you brought up a very important point. The judge, the Reagan appointee, thank God we have one on the D.C. federal court.
Federal court
made a very good point, and that is that Mueller's power is not unlimited. Every special counsel has a charge. Essentially, what Mueller is now arguing legally is that he is, in fact, the Attorney General of the United States. He has swept aside the Justice Department. He will investigate anyone for anything he chooses, because anything in the United States, any potential crime can be related to what he's investigating. Basically, he has become the Justice Department in his mind, in his warped mind.
Right. And the judge also said, and that's Judge Ellis, he said, you really don't care about Mr. Manafort's bank fraud. He said, you really care about what information he might give you about Mr. Trump and what might lead to his impeachment or prosecution. He says, you're covering bank fraud in 2005 and 2007. Tell me how. How does that have anything to do with your investigation of President Trump?
It's just leverage. He's looking for anything. He would investigate a potential crime from Paul Manafort in the year 1978 when Manafort was in law school. He'd investigate something like that to get leverage over him to try to force him to talk.
Exactly. And this is a kind of a squeeze play. And if you look at how Mueller and some of his associates and colleagues on his team have treated those within their realm, for example, they don't not only dragged out Manafort in the middle of the night, they dragged out his wife in the middle of the night. They threatened Michael Flynn's son with prosecution, which many have said
middle of the night? In other words, who? The Bureau served the warrants and the marshals were serving warrants in the middle of the night? What was the purpose of that, I wonder?
You know, it's just a tactic. I think it's a scare tactic. It really is just the abuse of power and the exercise of power in order to intimidate. That's how I read that. There is no reason. If you have perhaps potential bank fraud in 2005 and 2007, there's no reason that you need to storm in the middle of someone's house at night and harass his wife even. I don't understand those tactics, but these tactics are not foreign to many people on Mueller's team.
So let me ask you this. Give us some advice. Okay, we're offering this reward. I won't say how much. We'll save that for Friday. How do we target this, Megan? How do we get whistleblowers out? This is something Larry and I are going to really work on this. How do we do it? I'd love your advice.
Well, I think money is always a good carrot. Everyone has a price,
yep.
Right? Especially
yep.
in D.C.
Course.
Hillary Clinton had a price when
yep.
it came to selling our uranium.
Yep, that's
she
what
had, you know,
yes, she did.
Yeah. So, you know, Bill Clinton had a price when talking to Russian oligarchs at $500,000 a pop. So, you know, I think money is always a good carrot. But I also think the rule of law, like when you have a liberal Hillary supporter, Alan Dershowitz, come out against this Mueller witch hunt, and these investigative tactics and the storming of a lawyer's office violating attorney-client privilege. I think these types of tactics really do strike at many chords, even in the chords of the left like Alan Dershowitz. And so I think that if perhaps the tables were turned and Trump used these types of tactics against his political enemies in a weaponized government, why haven't we in the middle of the night raided Hillary Clinton or Uma Abedin's home or their lawyers' homes? Why aren't the lawyers of Hillary Clinton?
Trump hasn't even investigated. He's barely even investigated Hillary. He's been very judicious about it.
Right. And so I think that there is really the rule of law that strikes a chord with many people, especially if the tables were turned. But money is always a good carrot.
Megan Barth giving us good counsel, presidential analyst, founder and proprietor of ReaganBabe.com. ReaganBabe.com. You got to look it up. Megan, if we're real lucky, we'll be able to have you back again. Thank you so much. Coming up next, the Iranian deal. Stay tuned.
All the stories and controversies that no one talks about, but everyone should know about.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Later in the show, we'll be talking all things primaries. This week's Republican primaries, Brother Greg Corumbus joins us to break them all down. Don't miss it. Also, the state of journalism. Don't miss that. We'll be talking all things the state of journalism coming up after this segment. But first and foremost, Dr. Harlan Ullman joins us, former advisor to the Pentagon, served on the senior advisory group for the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, 2004 to 2016. Also a senior advisor at Washington, D.C.'s Atlantic Council. Doctor, that's quite a resume. I can barely read it. You did it. I can barely read it.
You spent too much time on it, Jack, but good to be with you. Well, you also can add, I have a new book just out called Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts Since the End of World War II.
Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts Since the End of World War II. And where can they get it?
Amazon is the best place. They probably even give you a good deal or any good bookstore.
All right. Check out Anatomy of Failure. All right. Speaking of failure of all kinds, let's talk about Iran, an area where you have great expertise. I think you and I, it goes without saying, I'm sure you and I agree the Iranian deal was nonsense and junk to begin with. But now I think Trump is skillfully exiting the deal. I want to take everyone behind the curtain, no pun intended here, the theme of our show. I think, Doctor, I'll see if you agree with me, and I have some sources telling me this from inside the administration, that Trump wants to strike a grand bargain with the Europeans on tariffs. And the real reason that Macron and Merkel came to Washington was not so much to lobby on the Iran deal. They could have done that over the phone. They came here to have a real intensive conversation about a trade involving a tariff deal and the Iranian deal. What do you say?
Well, I'm afraid, Jack, we should have a longer conversation because I could not disagree with you more.
The joint
comprehensive plan of action was indeed the only way to prevent Iran from ever gaining a nuclear
weapon. So you like John Kerry's thing here. You like it.
Let me repeat. If you read the entire document through and through, if Iran abided by it, it would never get a nuclear weapon, period. And the reason is that it would have a permanent regime of inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, if you criticize the deal saying at some stage Iran could enrich uranium, sure, but it's the inspection regime. And to make the argument that somehow, somewhere, Iran has secret facilities that are going to produce a bomb doesn't understand the huge network and the nuclear infrastructure that's required either to make uranium or plutonium. I had the experience of serving with nuclear weapons in two different navies, the American Navy and the Royal Navy, and unfortunately I have real background in the nuclear infrastructure. Now, if you have other problems with the agreement, because it didn't affect ballistic missiles, that's correct. It didn't affect Iran interference in regional affairs, that's correct. But if you believe that it was important to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons ever, then you would have supported the deal.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Okay, so we agree. Maybe we can agree to disagree on all that. Why did the Iranians make this deal? Because they were so desperate, they basically caved. In other words, are you making Obama's argument that our diplomacy was so adept that Iran eventually caved?
No.
is that what happened here?
No. Iran got to the stage where, under certain circumstances, it had the technology to make a nuclear weapon if it ever so desired. And having reached that stage, it said, okay, we can negotiate to try to get rid of these sanctions. Now, interestingly, this is a similar argument to what Kim Jong-un of North Korea is doing. Kim believes because he's got a few nuclear weapons and long-range rockets, he now has reached a degree of strategic parity with the United States because he can threaten us. And because he's got this sense of security, he can now negotiate an agreement. Interestingly, there's a parallel here. We'll see how the Korean agreements work out. But for the meantime, unfortunately, I think that the president may have started a unspiraling of not only our relations with Europeans, because more than tariffs, as you suggest, but also what's going to happen next in the Middle East.
All right.
Is unpredictable.
Do you think, though, that Trump may be working some kind of grand bargain? In other words, if you're Donald Trump, let's leave the substance aside. If you're Donald Trump, obviously you don't just want to cave on the Iranian nuclear question. You want to exit it so then you can get something for it if you choose to come back. If you just cave right away, then the U.S. gets nothing in any negotiations and they move on to the next issue, right? Don't you want to build this up strategically into something big with the Europeans and others? So we say, well, we'll do this, or we'll do most of it if you agree to these farm tariffs and these steel tariffs.
I think, Jack, you're more clever than the White House. I think that Donald Trump is approaching this as he does real estate deals. They're one-off and they can be handled separately. We have three major issues ongoing: the Korean negotiation, what's happened with the Iran nuclear deal, and, of course, the tariffs. These are all interconnected. And my sense is that Trump believes that by putting economic sanctions on Iran, he can force them back to the negotiating table. I think that is a profound misreading of the Iranian and the Persian culture and personality. But I think that that's the way that Donald Trump is looking at it. And if they don't come back, I think that certainly John Bolton believes the economic pressures could cause a revolution or could cause the downfall of the regime in Tehran. And I can only tell you, don't forget history. During the Vietnam War, we thought we could escalate so much the North Vietnamese were going to quit. They didn't. Similarly, and we went into Iraq the second time. We didn't have a plan for what next. I'd like to know what Donald Trump's plan is for what next. If he does have a grand bargain, it would be useful to leak that. But I think that your imaginative approach, I'm not sure that that's something that the White House has been able to.
You know, though, the argument, I've heard this argument, Doctor, for a long time, that this or that strategy will produce some kind of genuine nationalist revolution in Iran. We had that in 2009, and Obama essentially blew it, right? That you had that going on. I mean, essentially it was a CNN-driven revolution, but we could have exercised the ghost of Mossadegh, right? But we didn't do that. We let it all go, and the mullahs crushed it. Isn't that what happened?
Well, I think that the mullahs would have crushed it no matter what. This was not 1954 and Mossadegh. But I agree with you. The Obama administration has made profound mistakes, and I have been more critical with them, obviously, because they've been in power longer than I have with the Trump administration. But the issue here, and it's the thesis of my book, one of the reasons we get into so much trouble is that we elect presidents who are inexperienced, last for our exercise, poor strategic judgment, and do not have specific enough knowledge and understanding of the situations in which they become engaged. Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson had no idea what was happening in Vietnam. George W. Bush did not have an idea what was happening in Iraq in 2003. And Barack Obama didn't know what he was doing. We went to Libya in 2011.
Okay, let me ask you this now. If Trump, what's the fallout? If Trump exits the nuclear deal, does the deal fall apart entirely? What happens?
Well, this is the really interesting part. First of all, Iran will go through the protest mechanism in the JCPOA. My guess is they will go to the world court and declare what the United States did as illegal and try and drive a wedge between us and our allies, because Trump will say to our allies, if you trade with Iran, I'm going to impose secondary sanctions. You've already seen that done with Boeing and Airbus. Airbus is a European company, as you well know. And so there's going to be a huge amount of diplomatic and legal action by Iran. But more importantly, the Russians stand the most to gain by this, because they're going to use this to say, first of all, you can't trust the Americans. In good faith, they've left a good deal. They're going to try to use this in terms of propaganda, misinformation, to divide further the West from the United States, and that could happen. Also, you're going to see Iran, I think, take some aggressive actions, whether it's going to be in Yemen or with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah will have been elected to lead the Lebanon's government. So you've got all sorts of
implications here. Dr. Harlan Ullman, his new book, Anatomy of Failure. We'll be right back.
This is a universe where everything is depicted as a Washington Post political cartoon.
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Coming up next, we'll get into all things primary results this week. Don't miss it. Remember, if you want to take it behind the curtain, you call us 703-795-5364. 703-795-5364. Taking your emails now. Coming into the 20th century, not the 21st, jackberkman2016@gmail.com. jackberkman2016@gmail.com. Same number, same email. If you know anything about the Seth Rich murder mystery, we will not quit on the Rich family ever or the city of Washington. We will find the killer. Some more news coming up this spring, later in the spring, June, maybe July, maybe early summer. We will have a rally of 1,000 people. We're going to rally 1,000 people in and around the anniversary date of Seth's death, which was July 10th, probably at some point before. And we're going to take 1,000 people, and we will canvass Seth's neighborhood, going out in concentric circles. It'll be the biggest canvassing yet, and we will find whoever is responsible. Well, right now joining us, Rick Amato, host Politics and Profits with Rick Amato on the RAD TV network. And his website, AmatoTalk.com. Rick, welcome.
Hey, Jack. Great to be with you. And I noticed before coming on, like myself, you're originally from Pittsburgh.
Indeed. So where are you from in the burg?
I think we all now know the true reason why you were boycotting the Dallas Cowboys.
Aha, that's funny. That's funny. You remember that from years ago. Where were you from in the burg? We'll bore our viewers.
Pleasant Hills.
I was from Swissvale. So our viewer is now in Western Pennsylvania. We got a Swissvalian. I bet you didn't know that. And a guy from Pleasant Hills. Everybody in Western Pennsylvania just woke up. Maybe we got some new viewers. All right, Rick, I want to talk to you now about the state of journalism. I mean, there are a lot of things going on, but basically what people say is everything is becoming biased red meat. Everything is becoming op-ed TV. There is no more news. All you have now is bias everywhere you look. You got, you know, MSNBC and CNN on the left and Fox on the right and Newsmax on the right and whatever network you're looking at. It's one thing or the other, and it's nothing but biased. What do you say?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, I don't know how it happened or when it happened, but it certainly has gotten more extreme. I think that a lot of these networks, you can say they're driven by ideology, which they are, of course, are. But I think in many cases they're driven by profit, which there's nothing wrong with that. Which they are catering
to. God forbid!
To their base.
Shame on you, profit! Shame on you! Shame on you!
They're catering to their base and delivering news through a tent, which will appeal to their base.
Okay, true enough. Now, true enough. Well said, but. Hasn't it always been that way? I mean, I remember the 1890s. Well, I don't remember them personally. But, I mean, if you look at the Spanish-American War, the Hearst Papers, the 1890s, first part of the 20th century, all of these arguments were made before. Frankly, if you look at the 60s, 70s, and 80s in the United States prior to cable news, you had an all left-wing bias. It was just minus the conservatives, right? ABC, CBS, CNN, and NBC. All left-wing for decades with no conservative presence. Hasn't there always been pretty much an all-biased media? Is there some golden age when the media wasn't biased?
You're probably right about that. It would appear to be more extreme today.
Okay.
And maybe it's more extreme because there's competition.
That's a good point. I never thought. Perhaps maybe you reach a certain critical mass where it has to be extreme in order to go forth.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when there was no Fox News, then, you know, reporting could be done perhaps occasionally down the center without any concern about ramifications.
This issue really doesn't worry me at all. It's something that's widely talked about. We're talking about it here today. It doesn't worry. When the Founding Fathers looked down from heaven, most of them from heaven, maybe some of them looking up from hell. But when they look down, I think they see a creation that they are very proud of. I think they see everything they wanted to see. I think they see the country that's leading the world that they knew it would. I think they see a Congress that every time a bill fails in Congress, they say, good, we wanted to make it hard. Every time they see a crisis with the Constitution, they say, good, we believe in separation of powers. And every time they see this thing that people criticize as cacophony, they say, good, it's pluralism. That's what we want. It's the First Amendment. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I do. I often think about that. I think that they would be a little stunned and disappointed to see that race relations are still an issue. And again, that's been politicized, but I think they look down and say,
you might be right about that.
Amazing.
You might be right about that, although we'd have to look back to their time. I don't know that race was really much of an issue in the late 18th century. So maybe the whole business, maybe said another way, the whole business of the way in which the race debate evolved in America would surprise them. Maybe they would have never expected a civil war. I mean, God knows. It's just we'd have to go back and sort it out. But that's a it's an interesting point. How does fake news factor into all this?
How does fake news? I think it's always been there, I think. It's always been there through an agenda. The irony is it's what the old Soviet Union used to accuse the West of for years, and we mocked them, and I think for good reason. But to me, it's kind of ironic that here we see that today we're using the term fake news. And all that it is, as you know, John, is news said through the prism of an agenda.
So it's, in other words, that's very interesting. You see fake news, and I didn't even expect this, but maybe it's related to this topic in that it's part and parcel of and is another facet of the biased news of today.
Oh, absolutely.
It's, in other words, it's just an arrow in the quiver. It's just a tool in the toolbox. It's just another way in which people deliver biased news.
Exactly. Yeah. You can, and as you know, you can tell the same story, cover the same story, but how you say it, how you present it, gives two different meanings.
Now, let me...
For example...
Go ahead, sorry, go ahead.
When Trump was elected, before inauguration, as you know, and your listeners are aware, there was the protest in New York City. That was a fake protest, where... CNN covered this story.
Now they're creating the protests. CNN's creating. They're creating their own protests.
And they're interviewing a fake person who says that she's worried that there's going to be here. She's worried that there's going to be blacks killed in the streets now that Trump is president.
Yeah, Don Lemon running around giving everybody pink jackets and running around making sure he has exactly the speakers he wants lined up. I mean, but to digress for a minute, all of these things, all of these rallies, I mean, leaving aside CNN, the really bad stuff, but I mean, all of these rallies are put together by consultants, right, on both sides. I mean, consultants, people like me are hired to stage rallies. I mean, the public doesn't understand. College kids don't just get out of bed and protest. They get out of bed if you give them beer, pizza, and everything else. I mean, they're not going to, there's no such thing as a college kid getting out of bed and saying, I'm going to go protest Obama or Bush or something. That's a joke. That's a joke.
Right. Sounds like you followed me around for 4 years.
Oh, that's a joke. All of that's a joke. So where do you see things going? Going back to the biased media, how do you see this evolving? Do you see it getting worse? Do you think we'll come to a point where it changes? What do you see happening here?
So I think it gets worse. I think it creates cynicism. It creates distrust in the media, which is not always a bad thing. On the other hand, to have mistrust, to allow people to reflect and digest before swallowing the news, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, so to speak. I see that, you know, for years, here's a concept that I'm not aware of. I just read about it today, that for years, Democrats have floated the idea of not offering media credentials, but instead requiring journalists to be licensed. I don't know what those barriers are. And today, it appears that the president is talking about just that, creating a licensing format and taking away credentials. What does all that mean? I don't know. Just because you're licensed doesn't mean all of a sudden you're better, but it could raise the bar. But I think things get worse. The good side, again, I know I'm repeating, but I think people will be forced to wave in news and not just accept it. But here's the other thing. We just saw some recent news that Sinclair Broadcasting Network, a friend of mine is on the board there, Armstrong Williams. Sinclair Broadcasting will be forming a relationship with the Tribune Company, and they wanted to compete with Fox News. So you've got that. You have Newsmax doing their thing. And then something that has not been announced yet, and I can't say much about this, but I know of another group of media entrepreneurs who will also be launching a national television network with a goal of competing with Fox News Network.
Well, Fox News has moved to the center. I mean, I see them now as a centrist outlet. Well, Rick, I wish we got to talk more about this. I so wish you and I had more time. We could go on for days with this. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Rick Amato, host Politics and Profits with Rick Amato on the RAD Network, AmatoTalk.com. Rick, thank you very much. Coming up next, Brother Greg Corumbus joins us to talk all things election 2018. Stay tuned.
All the stories and controversies that no one talks about, but everyone should know about.
Why don't you get a toupee with some brains in it?
Behind the Curtain with Jack Berkman.
Welcome back. Remember, if you want to take it behind the curtain, you call us 703-795-5364, 703-795-5364. Operator standing by, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday. We want to hear from you. Emails, jackberkman2016 at gmail. Jackberkman2016 at gmail. You know it, coming into the 20th century, not the 21st. Same number, same email. If you know anything about the Seth Rich murder mystery, remember this Friday, big press conference here in Roslyn. Don't miss it. My friend Larry Klayman and I are going to offer a reward for whistleblowers who have dirt and evidence of criminality on Bob Mueller's investigation. Come on now. A lot of you are there. Come out, step out, do the right thing. Let's get the devil, capital D, capital T, as I refer to him in my tweets. Greg Corumbus, welcome.
Hey, Jack, how are you?
Well, we're not going to talk about the devil, even though I'd love to plunge into the devil, but we're going to talk about something even more important, which is the world of the Republican primary results of this week. So much going on. Give me your overall sense of this, to the extent there is an overall sense. I mean, there's results all over the place.
Yeah, there's four different states. Three of them had Senate primaries. The one that didn't was North Carolina, but West Virginia, Ohio, and Indiana did. All are states, obviously, that President Trump won. All are states with Senate Democrats on the ballot. Two of them are seen as especially good pickup opportunities for Republicans, namely West Virginia and Indiana. And if it's a good night, they could potentially win in Ohio as well, since Trump won that state by about 7 or 8 points. What we saw on Tuesday was basically a massive sigh of relief in West Virginia and pretty much what we expected in Indiana and Ohio. You know, you had Don Blankenship, the old Massey energy head who went to jail for a while, spent the tail end of his campaign referring to the current Senate Majority Leader as Cocaine Mitch, and his McConnell's in-laws as China people. And this was just a nightmare waiting to happen for the Republicans. In the end, whether or not Trump's tweet helped, Don Blankenship finished a distant third, didn't even get to 20%. The most conservative candidate in the race, Patrick Morrisey, the attorney general who sued the Obama administration over transgender policies, perhaps most importantly in West Virginia over the clean air EPA rule, which could have killed the coal industry effectively in West Virginia. He's also a favorite of pro-Second Amendment groups and pro-life. Patrick Morrisey won the primary over Congressman Evan Jenkins by about 5 or 6 points. So he takes on Joe Manchin now. Joe Manchin got a little bit of a stronger competition from the far left challenger in that race. In the end, he still beat her by better than 2-1. In Indiana, this was supposed to be a race against two congressmen. They ended up slinging so much mud against each other that the third candidate, a guy named Mike Braun, yeah, the briefly a state legislator, mostly a business owner in Indiana. He ends up winning by double digits, and he will take on Joe Donnelly, who is probably the most vulnerable Democrat in this cycle. And then in Ohio, it's Congressman Jim Renacci, who's going to be lining up against Sherrod Brown.
Now, Braun, that's a good encapsulation, Greg. You did it all in one breath. Wonderful. That's why I call you the best political analyst in television. You do it all in one breath. I actually think Braun ran a very Trump-like campaign, right? Yep. And I actually think he was the best in Indiana. I think he's the strongest to take on Donnelly. Do you agree?
Well, probably, because one of the things that we're seeing in a lot of different races already is that being an incumbent member of Congress isn't popular even among people in your own party.
Yes.
They want something different. And what we saw in West Virginia, what we saw in Indiana, at least in the primary, it probably won't be quite as intense in the general election, is who aligns themselves most closely with Trump. And Braun certainly can make that case. He's a business guy who's filthy rich and was able to pump about $5.5 million of his own money into the campaign while all these congressmen are over here, Luke Messer and Todd Rokita, are out there trying to strangle each other. Meanwhile, the third guy waltzes right past him by a wide margin.
You know, the other lesson I think of this week is that Trump is becoming more skillful about using his influence, right? He's more choosy, more skillful, more tactical. You saw that in West Virginia. He did a good job, right?
Well, this is probably the lesson of Roy Moore, although if you look back at the Roy Moore race, Donald Trump was endorsing Luther Strange until Moore won the Republican nomination. So you had Donald Trump saying, don't vote for Blankenship. He said, vote for either Evan Jenkins or Patrick Morrissey. And some folks in each of those campaigns obviously would have liked a specific endorsement. Didn't happen. But he's not going around saying, I want this guy. I want this guy in too many races. And some he did with Renacci in Ohio. He did with Ron DeSantis, who's running for governor of Florida. He already has. So he is picking and choosing his spot.
All right. So if we look now, it seems to me that the race, the issue of control in Congress in 2018 is getting closer. If you go back 3 months, both of us might have thought, and maybe you still think, that we would wind up with a Democratic House. Maybe Republicans would have only had a pickup of one or even none in the Senate, right? But I see Republicans doing much better now than 90 days ago. Do you agree?
Well, yes. This has been a great week for the president. When you think of freed North Korean hostages, scrapping the Iran deal, and pretty successful primaries this week.
It's not that you'd know from watching CNN.
Well, that might be the case. They're still talking about Stormy a lot of the time. But the problem is that this is May, and so we're 6 months away almost from Election Day, and we know how fast the news cycle changes. So we don't know what's going to happen, and we don't know what will be the topic of the chatter at that time. But it's what's also interesting, in addition to who won these primaries, is that Republican primary voter participation was way up in West Virginia, Indiana, and Ohio. Democrats was up a little bit, but not as much as Republicans compared to back in 2014 in those midterms. So that is also encouraging for the GOP.
What is causing the base? What's causing this? So obviously it's a good trend for Trump and Republicans, but what is causing this? Why is the base getting more excited? What's going on here?
Well, I think you can see a number of things, and it probably depends on which office you're talking about. We've been talking mostly about the Senate, and the Republicans can have a pretty strong argument here that, you know, two seats flip here. Chuck Schumer's the Senate Majority Leader, and that means everything in the Trump agenda is grinding to a halt. If there's any Supreme Court vacancies or other judicial vacancies, Chuck Schumer's going to be the one who decides when and if any of that ever happens. You better believe that after the Merrick Garland example, he's going to be slow walking any judicial appointments before the 2020 race if the Democrats get control, and they can pretty much stifle any other legislative agenda the president has as well. So you can talk about the Democrats being obstructionists, and if the Republicans can get some more things on the scoreboard while they still have the majority, that'll probably help them as well.
But of course, in the Senate, they need plus two. And Democrats retaking the Senate in 18, that's almost impossible. That would have to be, you would need major change between now and November.
Yeah, you probably would. I mean, they've got a decent shot, I would say better than average, of winning the Nevada seat that Dean Heller has right now, and probably the open Jeff Flake seat. And depending on the health of Senator McCain, there could be a second race in Arizona this year. They have hopes of doing well in Tennessee. That race is tighter right now than a lot of people expected. In the end, it's a deeply red state, and I'd be surprised if the Democrats won it, but it could be competitive
question,
and could cost us a lot of money.
Question about Arizona, not to interrupt. God forbid if John McCain were to pass this year, what would happen in Arizona? Would there be a race on Election Day? Or what's the Arizona law? I forget.
Yeah, it's interesting because the state legislature just tried to change this. It basically all depends on whether or not he survives the month of May, or at least keeps his Senate seat through the month of May. If the seat were to come open before the end of the month, there has to be a special election later this year. If it happens June 1st or later, the governor can appoint a replacement until the 2020 cycle.
Now, what do we know about John McCain? I hate to ask, do we know know anything? I mean, is there any? Is he in some kind of immediate peril? Am I missing something?
Well, you know, you basically infer things from various media reports. The fact that he's putting his funeral plans together, because they had that whole uproar earlier in the week about whether he was going to invite Trump, which apparently he's not. There's, you know, reports Orrin Hatch saying he's not expected back at the Senate. And just the fact that the Arizona Republican legislature was looking to change the law, which they were unsuccessful in doing, in order to give the governor power earlier than the end of May to make an appointment, would suggest that perhaps he doesn't have a lot of time left. But that is entirely speculative from what we're hearing. He's a receiving visitor still at his ranch, old politician friends and so forth, and he's still up and around. So we'll see how it goes.
Boy, if you have two open races in Arizona, which has now become really for the first time in history an expensive state with the Phoenix market, Republicans had better get ready to raise an awful, I guess so do Democrats, but we're going to need an awful lot of money, Greg. Greg, about a minute remaining. I think just one more question, if I can. In the House, can Republicans overcome the retirements? Retirements seem to be the main problem. If it weren't for the retirements, Republicans would probably easily hold the House. Can they overcome all these retirements?
I think they'll hold most of those because most of the people retiring are in relatively safe Republican districts. I think the bigger problem for them is that the Republicans have done so well in 2010, 2014, 2016. Usually there's a momentum that kind of picks you up a few extra seats that are very, very marginal in terms of a Republican advantage in the district. And if there's a Democratic edge in 2018, those are the ones that are going to be most vulnerable.
We're almost like the Democrats in the 30s. Well, maybe not quite that much, but we have a lot of ground, a lot of territory to defend, and it's almost impossible to be that broad this day and age because the country's divided.
Exactly. I think the biggest advantage for Republicans in the House, which seems odd considering the projections right now, is that they did so well in 2010. They were able to define their own congressional boundaries, define the districts in most of these heavily populous states, and so that should mean that they were redistricted in a way that advantages Republicans. Now, they changed the rules in Pennsylvania and a couple other places, and so we'll see if that makes much of an impact. But that's what's working for the Republicans right now.
Greg Carambas, thanks. If you want to take it behind the curtain, or if you need something brought to Congress that you can't do yourself, we'll do it for you right here at Behind the Curtain. You call us 703-795-5364, 703-795-5364. Operators taking your calls Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5. Remember, even when we're not on the air, you can hear us and see us and read all about us at jackberkmanradio.com and, of course, always at radioamerica.com. Thanks. We'll see you again.